Welcome. My name is Chris Gilbertson, and this is the Secrets of the Extraordinarily Successful podcast, where I interview top experts and multimillionaires in the areas of business, marketing, and mindset to help you explode your business and create a lifestyle of your dreams. So tune in weekly as I share key insights from these interviews to help you master your mindset, learn simple strategies that easily grow your business, and teach you the roadblocks to avoid on your journey. And to learn how to drive more traffic to your website, double your email opt-in rate, and easily increase sales in your business and create passive income, make sure to subscribe at www.chrisgilbertson, that's Chris with a K, for free multimedia marketing updates to help you in your business. Now for today's episode.
Awesome. All right. Well, welcome. This is Chris, and you're listening to the Secrets of the Extraordinarily Successful, where I interview top experts and multimillionaires in the areas of business, mindset, health, and fitness to help you explode your business as an entrepreneur. And today, my guest, I am so excited to have on the show. We are going to have an absolute blast and a riot. You're going to take a ton of content away from this. And I'm so excited about him because he's the founder and host of the Blogcast FM podcast and blog. It is one of the hottest blogs in the iTunes market, or excuse me, podcast in the iTunes marketplace. And Srini, he is phenomenal at interviewing. And that's why I'm so excited about our show today, because so many of you are starting to create your own web-based shows. And you always ask questions about how to interview, how to get connections, and how to grow your audience through your own personality and brand. And we're going to get into that. But I just want to share with you, if you're not familiar with the Blogcast FM podcast yet, he's interviewed Danielle Laporte. She's the author of the Firestarter Sessions. Michael, the best-selling author, Book Yourself Solid. Mike Stelzner, the founder CEO of Social Media Examiner. There's so many other top experts that they've interviewed. And I just want to share just a sneak peek of some of the results that they've had just in a short while of producing their show. They literally have over 500,000 downloads on a monthly basis and rapidly growing. They get anywhere from 25,000 to 175,000 downloads per episode. And they're in the top episodes in iTunes for all their interviews. And 95% of their listeners listen to the entire show, which is just record breaking. That's phenomenal. Srini's also the author of the Small Army Strategy that he just launched on Amazon. So make sure to go head over there. And then he also has his own coaching business as well at the School of Life that we're going to get into and talk all about. So without further ado, I want to get started and bring Srini on the line. So welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks, Chris. It's kind of fun to be on the other side of the mic. You know, it's not something I get to do very often, although it's happening a lot more lately for some reason.
So, good.
I'm excited to chat with you.
Well, you have so much incredible information and you are such a phenomenal interviewer. I want to get the Srini side of the story, the other side. So let's get into it. Like we both start our interviews. I want to hear your background, how you got started as an entrepreneur, your story, and then we're going to kind of go into some awesome content later too.
Yeah. Like many people, I kind of ended up here, I guess you could say serendipitously. There's a lot of things that didn't go as planned in my life. I spent 10 years in corporate America, but unlike the typical sort of solo entrepreneur that you find that has this thriving career in corporate America, I was really just a corporate misfit in every way imaginable. And, you know, it's funny, I think about something that one of our recent guests told me. He said, you know, he was professionally unemployable by corporate America. And I thought, yeah, that about describes me. I was never one of these people that ended up getting promoted multiple times. I was never like the six-figure earner. I was somebody who truly just was always average and mediocre at being in corporate America. I worked in sales at a couple of market research companies, but I was always tied to technology. And I realized I didn't want to be in sales for the rest of my life, so I decided to push the reset button on my career, and I went back to business school, which, funny enough, now I would never recommend that to anybody, but this was 2007. Things hadn't really taken off. I mean, it's amazing how much things have changed in the last 3 to 4 years.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And you know, it's funny because people would ask me during business school, what do you plan to do with your career? I said, as long as it has nothing to do with the internet, that is going to be my career, because I am completely done with all this internet nonsense. Because I'd spent 10 years in Silicon Valley. I wanted nothing to do with technology. So that's, you know, ironic as that seems considering what I do now. But I went back to business school, and the summer between my first and second year of business school, I didn't get the internship I wanted, which was working on a casino floor at Harrah's, basically in casino operations. So I ended up working at Intuit as their social media intern in the TurboTax group. And during that time, I started just dabbling with content. And I didn't get a job offer at the end of my time at Intuit. And then the second year of business school happened. I mean, I was always sort of dabbling with blogging and content creation.
Yeah.
And when I got out, of school, I was watching kind of what was happening in the economy. I was watching people use blogs to get hired, to get all these interesting opportunities. I mean, the stories started coming through the mainstream media. And so I started this really silly site called 100 Reasons You Should Hire Me, which was an epic failure. It was really nothing more than the bullet points on my resume in blog form. But I got attention with it. And I realized if I could actually learn to do it properly, maybe there might be something here. So that ended up resulting in the School of Life, which is my personal blog. And as a part of that, I started this weekly series called Interviews with Up-and-Coming Bloggers. And really, so what is now Blogcast FM literally started as nothing more than a weekly blog post on my blog. And after about 13 interviews, one of the guys that I interviewed came back to me and said, you know, I think that you should take this off of the School of Life and spin it out as a separate site because it will be a lot more successful then. In the midst of this, I did end up getting a day job. I mean, part of the reason I started these online projects was not to actually make them my career, but because I wanted them to lead to a day job working in social media. And I worked at this online travel company, did that for about a year and a half, ended up getting laid off from there. And before the layoff, my hours got reduced to 10 hours a week. So I lived in Costa Rica for 6 months where I surfed every day. One of the readers of my blog and a woman who listens to my show actually ended up setting me up with rent-free housing for the entire 6 months I was there.
Awesome.
And so, you know, my brand started becoming this sort of, you know, relationship marketing guy because, I mean, I was having all these things not necessarily monetarily happen, but a lot of amazing things were happening because of the connections I was making online. And so bit by bit, eventually I just started doing more freelance work. Blogcast FM started becoming really the core of what I do. I came back from Costa Rica. That was probably a year and a half ago. And really, I've been just hammering at all of this stuff ever since. And I realized going back to a normal job is – I think that ship sailed a long time ago. And it's funny. Like, you know, we say professionally unemployable, and I think many of us are becoming professionally unemployable. But I don't see that as a bad thing. It's a blessing and a curse to some degree. But at the same time, you know, I interviewed this guy, Patrick Vlaskovitz, recently, who wrote the book called The Lean Entrepreneur, and he told me something that really kind of struck a chord with me that somebody had told him in graduate school. He said, you know, Patrick, you're going to have to create demand for yourself in order to make money. And I realized that's exactly what my life is, you know, because I spent so much of it forcing square pegs into round holes, trying to do things that I wasn't good at, which is really easy to do because that's what you're taught to do from a very young age. Conformity is something you've been rewarded for up until several years. And until about 2 years ago, it was, you know, take this path and it will lead to where you think it's going to lead. Well, for me, it all fell apart in a matter of months. You know, I got out of business and it was like watching everything I'd built my whole life just come crumbling down like a house of cards. Mm-hmm. So I realized at that time it might be time to start questioning this whole conventional wisdom thing. So I'll turn it back over to you because I could yap on endlessly.
No, it's just – I just love hearing your story because we don't get to hear that often, the background of what happens. And I think, you know, as entrepreneurs, and even if you're just becoming an entrepreneur, the road has been crazy to get there, but it all is like a divine – purpose that unfolded, even though it seemed all crazy before. So I love hearing that because, you know, and it's interesting too, the people that have opened the doors up for you to, you know, like the woman that was reading the blog then said, hey, you should take this into the interview space, like actually connecting with people. So I love that. I think it's amazing. So what I'd love for you to share is really when you got started with your show, kind of what was the focus and how did you get started with that? Because that's a lot of people want to do that, but they have questions about it and they're not sure how to do it. And you just took off and just it exploded for you.
Well, you know, it's funny. It probably seems like that now. And so what's interesting, so I started really, the idea was to interview other bloggers. But what I realized was that I wasn't really known in the space of, nobody knew who I was. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to interview up and coming bloggers. I was in this program called Blog Mastermind, created by this guy named Yaro Starik. Blog Mastermind, I think, is no longer available, but Yaro is still around and he's still quite successful. And so I started, I just went in the forum and said, hey, I'm on lesson 17. Here's a lesson for people who are listening. If you're enrolled in any course, whatever it is, Chris, even if somebody's enrolled in your iTunes course, one of the things that I've seen people do is they buy courses and then they don't do any of the things in the course because it's really easy to spend $300 on something and put it aside.
Yep.
Well, I was in a position where I'd borrowed the money from my dad. And I said, look, it's going to cost $97 a month. So I knew he would be really pissed off if I didn't follow through on everything. That was my motivator to prove that, you know what, I am serious about this. But one of the lessons was to interview people. So I made sure that I was diligent about doing all the lessons. So what I did was I went in the online forum there and I said, hey, I'm on lesson 17 and this lesson is interviewing people. But What I knew was that interviewing up and coming bloggers was going to be the key because I was an up and coming blogger. So connecting with people at my same level would be easy as opposed to, hey, who is this random guy that nobody's ever heard of? I'm not going to reach out to Seth Godin. And we can talk about why I waited 300 interviews to interview Seth Godin too. That's actually something that I thought was really useful. But I realized that people at your same level are often underestimated as we're obsessed with authority and influence in the online world. We have this sort of hero-worshipping mindset. And the problem with that is that there are a lot of people at your same level or who are, sort of your peers who can be this honestly, my closest friends and the people that have really brought me to where I'm at are not the celebrity guests that I've interviewed, but the people who I have known as friends and who I started this journey with, and a lot of them were up-and-coming bloggers. So I started with this sort of core group of people, and I would ask for referrals. And it took 13 interviews before we even thought, okay, maybe there's more here than just doing a weekly blog post. That was kind of the idea for Blogcast FM. And it wasn't, I can't take credit even for coming up with the concept. One of the guys I interviewed, who was my first business partner, a guy named Sid Savara, he said, he didn't even want to be my business partner. He just thought it was a good idea. So I replied back and said, hey, that sounds great. When do you want to get started? And so he ended up coming along for the ride. And I mean, lucky for me, he had a lot of connections to influential people because he had already been blogging for quite some time. But I mean, he was probably my 13th interview. And so it kind of went from there. And that's why I always, one of my favorite sayings is emerging talent is the most undervalued asset on the entire blogosphere.
I love that. I mean, I love that. And I'm so glad that you said that because I think people, and I've been guilty of it too, where we just get a reverse mindset of who we need to be connecting with. And what's great is the people that are just up and coming, and some of the interviews that I've had, their content and their knowledge is so amazing, and people gravitate towards that because they feel that they can actually accomplish things by listening to what they're doing. It's really interesting because they're so new and maybe people don't know about them. And I love that, there's a lot of things that you just talked about that are so important. But, as for entrepreneurs, we want to have people that we surround ourselves with that understand what we're going through and what we're doing. And what you talked about, just your friends, it doesn't have to be like this crazy, huge, big advisory board. A lot of people think they need to have, big names with that. And I love that. And the other thing that I want you to talk about is taking action. I mean, you just stepped in and just, it sounds like everything that you get an idea on, do you implement pretty quickly? I mean, like as soon as you have the idea, are you like off of the ground running, or what's your process for
Okay,
that?
so it's funny you're talking about this because we just had a strategy call with our business coach the other day, and she made us table every idea we had. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I want to strangle you because I'm not the most patient person in the world. Luckily, my business partner David is much smarter about this because I am very impulsive. Like if I have an idea, here's the thing, it's a blessing and a curse. If I have an idea, I want it launched by the end of this week and I want the $1 million check in my bank account on Monday. And that doesn't work. That honestly, again, it's a blessing and a curse. Now, smaller ideas, there's a great book that I refer to a lot called Little Bets by a guy named Peter Sims, who's a venture capitalist. He talks about the innovation process that people like Pixar, people like Chris Rock, people like Steve Jobs all use. And the idea is to take small actions that won't break you or bankrupt you, but to be able to test concepts. I mean, even the last book I did really was nothing more than an experiment. And one thing I think about is conducting experiments that are sort of low maintenance, right? Things that won't necessarily bankrupt you or really hurt you. What Peter Sims essentially calls little bets. You look at it and you say, okay, I could do this thing. It's not going to require an insane amount of effort. It may generate a result, but even if it doesn't work, it's not going to be the end of the world. And the problem I've seen in the online world is a lot of people will have ideas and they don't act on them because they think they have to be perfect. And let me tell you, I've seen books from best-selling authors go to print that have typos in them. I know because my name is misspelled in one.
Oh no. But to that point though, it's so true. I mean, you have to, it's like building the ship as you fly it. And I think, I mean, I learned that the hard way too, is making it perfection. Harv Eker, I'm a big follower of him, and he always says, perfect mediocrity or sloppy success is better than perfect mediocrity any day. And it's so true. You just have to take the steps. So when you go through a process, because I'm just like you, where it's like, I've got all these ideas, I want to run 110 miles an hour in all these directions. But as entrepreneurs, our biggest, Saboteur is distraction. I mean, for all of us. So, what is your process, and how have you created a process that I know you have your business partner to help you with that, but for you yourself, because a lot of entrepreneurs, we have an addiction problem. We have, because we're going all over the place. How do you kind of work through that with your ideas and know which ones to work on and do the small steps for and move forward with?
I think about one where they could lead. There's certain ideas that are overly ambitious. I think that's obviously to some degree we all have that as entrepreneurs. I think that we all are extremely ambitious. We always look at everything being bigger than it could possibly be. And so I kind of look at that and say, okay, you know what? Maybe, but in a lot of ways, I think you kind of do what the minimum viable thing is to get you feedback and to figure out whether it's worth doing. And I used this process that I used on my last book. It was actually very much an experiment, but a very eye-opening one in terms of developing content. Because I was sharing huge chunks. I mean, you and I are friends on Facebook. I mean, I was putting out probably 3-4 paragraphs status updates, all of
It was
which
awesome.
made their way into the book. But I didn't know that I wanted to write. I mean, I had the idea for the book, but I just started throwing them out just to see how people would respond. And I noticed that I was striking a chord in a way that I never had before. So I knew that I had to be onto something here. But it was a really nice way to sort of test whether I keep going or not. And one of the things that I've seen, and I'm guilty of it as anybody, is people will spend weeks on end building something and then find out that nobody wants it. And that sucks. And so it was interesting with this book that I was so public. I mean, I more or less gave it away bit by bit. Nobody had to buy it, and yet they did it. In fact, I just found out it's number 3 in the advertising category on Amazon this morning.
Yay!
So
Congrats.
thanks. But so I look at one, how can I do, how can, one, am I going to learn from it, even if it doesn't work out? That's very important, because the thing is, if you do something that's completely useless and you spend a ton of time on it and you don't learn anything from it, well, then you've just wasted time. So I thought about this, what am I going to learn from this? At least I'll learn some lessons in book marketing. I'll learn some lessons in packaging a self-published book. Even though I'd done two before, I thought I'll also learn lessons in repurposing content. So I think about, what am I going to learn? To what am I going to lose if this thing fails, which is probably nothing. Seth Godin told me something when I asked him about how he takes projects from inception to launch. And he says, something he likes to say to himself is, this might not work. And the thing is that you have no attachment to it, because I think one of the things that we all do is we attach our sense of self to whatever the outcome is. People say, and it's easier said than done. I mean, I can sit here and I can tell you this, and I can tell you this as somebody who's having a book that is having some success. But I can honestly tell you, if the book flopped, I would probably feel pretty bad about it. But that being said, it is sort of, this idea that the results that you generate from your efforts don't define you as a person. And I've always, it's something that I'm trying to get my head around more and more, because I feel like once you can kind of really live that, you can start to do really interesting work.
That's brilliant. And I think that is one of the biggest lessons just as entrepreneurs in general is enjoying the journey and the process that we go through, the failures, the ups and downs. It's funny because I like to watch Shark Tank a lot, and they'll have those entrepreneurs that are just have fallen in love with their product for years and years and years, and they won't change anything. They won't adjust with it. They won't adjust with the market, what has changed. And that's so crucial as an entrepreneur going forward, especially like our technology, everything changes every 2 years. So we have to keep evolving and be flexible. And I love that you talk about that with the small steps. Take risks, but not risky risks where it's putting too much out there and you could lose the whole farm with just one idea.
Okay, so here's something that I wrote about recently, and I can't remember, it was one of our newsletters, and I talked about this idea of we overestimate the consequences of our risks. And the two worst possible things that could happen to you is either you die or you go to jail. Okay? And most of the online projects that people are holding back on, none of the things that, even if they fail epically, they're not going to experience those two consequences.
I love this. As you see, I'm taking a ton of notes right now, but I love that idea. It's brilliant. And yet, no one's ever said it that way, because when you think about it, It really is. Like I'll get I because I get overworked. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, what about this? What about this? And we get stressed out. And we make ourselves stressed out with the products we're working on. And really, you have to put it in perspective. You know, what's the worst that's going to happen? You know, I love that with Seth Godin too. You know, if it fails, you know, okay, so what do you learn from it, and then how do you move on? So let's talk about your book. And I love the content that you talked about, how you pieced it out on Facebook to get the interaction. And I just love that strategy. I loved when you were doing that, because it gave everybody, it was great, because I thought you were just doing it to for foreshadowing of this is, you know, it's the launch of the book. So tell me about that, and then what's in the book, and how that all got together.
Well, you know, the Facebook stuff, I honestly didn't, that was not intentional. Like, I really didn't sit down one day and say, you know what, I'm going to piece by piece give out concepts from this book on Facebook. So I had a few, so I had the idea for a book. Mark Schaefer, who I write for at his blog Grow, had mentioned that I had been riffing on a theme the entire year of 2012. And I thought, wait a minute, if I'm riffing on a theme, I wonder if I could take all the posts and package them into a book and see what happens. Because what, you know, I looked at this pattern. I realized that if you look at even some of our very well-known authors and our sort of heroes, even Seth Godin does this, even though he told me that he doesn't plan it this way when I interviewed him. I asked him about it. He said, Trine, you're imagining things. But if you look in his books, you'll actually see he does use a lot of content that he has written on his blog. And I realized, you know, it was a lesson in the fact that as a body of work, the impact is very different than an individual blog post. And that's a whole other conversation, which we can talk about in a second. But what I realized is I had all this content on Mark's blog, and I wanted to put something out there that was very representative of my sort of view, my worldview, that says, you know, this is how I view the online world. This is what really is important to me. But I also realized as the 12 or 13 blog posts that made up the book, it wasn't going to be enough. It needed coherence to it. It needed an arc and narrative. And I just started really thinking about a lot of concepts that I had heard over the last few years, and a lot of things that I started to notice with, you know, my own listeners, and a lot of different things. And so I started literally just throwing things on Facebook that were on my mind, because I would have these morning writing sessions and I would put stuff out there. And honestly, I didn't put them out there with the intention of putting them into the book. I wasn't using that stuff to put them in the book, but then I started to realize, I was like, wait a minute, this all kind of flows together. And so the book came together in this really sort of organic way that I didn't necessarily plan. I mean, I came up with the title, The Small Army Strategy. I knew that that was what I wanted to be called. I knew that I was going to have the blog post that I'd written for Mark Schaefer's blog as part of it. But all those other parts, the parts that were on Facebook, really made their way in there organically. And amazingly enough, as I started seeing the feedback, as I said, I started to notice I was really striking a chord with people. Something about this was really different than anything that I had written to date. Like, you know, I've been writing for probably 3 or 4 years now, but nothing has had that same effect with people. And so then I knew this needs to get into the book, because if this is what it's happening on Facebook, what's going to happen when people really read it?
I love the process that comes through, and I highly suggest everybody write a book because of the process that you go through and what you discover from yourself. But what was really interesting, I mean, there's a lot that you covered there, but what stands out right away is you knew your title. And see, a lot of people are the opposite. They have the content, but they don't have the title. So I like your strategy of putting that together, because did you already have a plan of wanting to write a book, or was it mainly kind of just that nudge of the theme and the places you were going already?
Okay, so one thing I didn't mention, which I should have mentioned when we talked about goals and actions, is I use this program called Pick Four, which is Seth Godin's adaptation of Zig Ziglar's goal setting program. Hands down, the most effective goal setting guide in the world, because what it does is it makes you sit down at the beginning of 12 weeks and write down these four goals. And every day you take action and you write down, what did you do today towards this goal? And it's amazing because it's really simple, but it works. And you know when you're not accomplishing something, because every day you say, you know what, I've done nothing towards this goal. Like, I have one of those on my 12-week list, and I realize, wow, I've done nothing towards this in like the last week, and I'm dangerously close to not accomplishing this goal in this next 12 weeks. But so, you know, that being said, things kind of changed. I mean, I had the idea for the Small Army Strategy, but I've already had two self-published books, and I wanted to do this one for a couple of reasons. One is that I wanted one, I wanted a level of authority associated with what I do and say, okay, you know what, this is what I stand for. And in some ways, I think this was a sequel to the first ebook I wrote called Relationship Marketing for Bloggers, but written in a much more eloquent way and written, you know, with my worldview after 300 interviews and 3 years on the web. So I think that's why it really struck a chord with people in a different way than it did before. So did I sit down and plan it right from the get-go? Not necessarily. I mean, I had the idea. It came to fruition a lot faster than I thought it would. One, because strangely enough, I mean, the concepts in the book are what made it happen because, you know, I have a small army that actually helped. I had David Crandall, my business partner, design a book cover. Somebody else who was following me on Facebook ended up editing the book for free because she happened to be a former book editor. I mean, bit by bit, like all these people came out of the woodworks to make it happen. And, you know, and I realized, you know, exactly. Because what I had done is I'd used all the concepts in this book over the course of the last 3 years. I had built a small army. And amazingly enough, they all came to my, you know, came to help me to make it happen.
I love that. And what I really like about the best about it too is that, I mean, I'm going through and reading this and then other works. I mean, I love all your work regardless. Your book has a total different tone though. It really does. It has that philosophical, there's so much more involved with it and it's a deeper level and just what you talked about your worldview, but you had to go through your other writing and to come into this. So the taking the action crafted this, you know, it's like 3.0, you know, Srini or whatever it is, you know, with the process. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something, that 80% of everything I write is complete garbage. Hey,
I think that's
seriously.
Everybody. Well, maybe not for, you know, great.
The thing
writers.
Is, I don't publish 80% of what I write either. You know, I mean, the amount of stuff that I have to go through to get to something decent, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not as disciplined as somebody like a Julian Smith who does 1,000 words of free writing every day, but I noticed a pattern. You know, when he mentioned that to me, he said, yeah, in doing that, maybe 100 words of it will be really brilliant. And then you build from that 100 words. And I noticed that pattern actually really works because I'll sit down and I'll hammer at the keyboard and nothing. I was having this conversation with Ryan Hanley the other day. There's a great movie called With Honors. I don't know if you've ever seen it, with Joe Pesci and this guy who is writing a senior thesis at Harvard. Brendan Fraser, I think, is the guy's name.
Oh, okay.
So anyways, you know, Joe Pesci reads his senior thesis. He's like, yeah, man, this stuff is really coming out the wrong end. And that's how I feel about my writing most of the time, you know. And that's honestly, like, most of it is really bad, but you have to go through that to get to the good stuff. I mean, and it's, again, you know, it's all a constant evolution. It's not something that is static, right? Like, now, here's the curse of the fact that this book is done as well as it has. Now you're like, okay, great. How do I repeat that? And that actually, believe it or not, and it's funny because I wrote about that in the book. The same thing that makes you popular, the minute you try to replicate that, that's how you water down your work.
Yeah. So, you know, just to kind of spin off on that, because a lot of people, entrepreneurs getting started, they hold themselves back because one, perfection, and then two, the fear factor. So do you think it's the fear, I know this is totally tangential, but do you think it's fear of success or what you talked about, the fear of being a success and then what happens after that to maintain it? Because I think it's kind of like the chicken and egg syndrome there of what people really think of what's holding them back.
You know, it's funny because I've heard so many people talk about fear of success and I always think, I'm like, that's such bullshit. I'm like, who would fear success? That makes no sense to me at all. It's like, you know, like, maybe I'm wrong. I don't, you know, I'm not in a position to speak, but I don't fear $1 million showing up in my bank account. If that happened, I'd be like, all right, sweet, I'm out of here. I'm going to go surf the world.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, it's funny. I guess fear of losing what you've already had, that may be what it is that traps people. Because it's funny. And everybody who has created anything that reaches a lot of people or has had some level of success will tell you that replicating – you get addicted to the glow. It really – honestly, that's the challenge. It's what I call the paradox of popularity. And – ironically, you know, what made you so good at what you did is you weren't addicted to the glow. You weren't trying to be popular. You weren't trying to create something that people would like. I think if you try to create something that you think other people are going to like, it's a recipe for disaster. I didn't write this book for the masses. I wrote it for the people who supported me day in and day out for the last year. The book is not about me or my worldview. It's about the experiences that I've had connecting with them. And like people are like, why is the book 99 cents? So it was like, because I didn't, you know, I didn't write, one, I didn't write it to make money. Because let's face it, books don't make money. I've had New York Times bestselling authors tell me books don't make money. So I figured, why waste my time with a book that a lot of people won't have access to? So that was another thing. But yeah, I think that I don't necessarily know if we fear success. I think we fear losing what we've already built. So yeah, I guess you could, maybe you could call it a fear of success. I don't know. That was a really roundabout way of explaining something.
That was great. I mean, because I think it's the fear of the success, and I like to hear different perspectives on it, because that's what a lot of people, it's all in their head is all it is, really. So it's once people can understand that and listen to themselves and move forward, they can start taking action and get over that. Because as soon as you start taking action, all that crap just disappears, because you don't have time. You're into what you're doing, and you're writing your book, you're doing your blog, you're doing your radio show, whatever it is, you know, you're taking action, and it curbs the rest of that. So I think that's great. So what I'd love to talk about is, let's talk about the show again for a second, because I want to talk for people that are new to maybe meeting you yet. One of my favorite quotes about your show is that people say, I can't believe it's free. I mean, you've got amazing testimonials, but that's my favorite one because of the content you get. I mean, literally, I've spent thousands of dollars on products to listen to a show and be like, oh my gosh, it's right here. So talk to us about how you go about interviewing, your style of interview, and then, well, I'll take one question at a time. Let's start with that.
You know, I take that as the greatest compliment. Like, you know, it is cool to see that. We do get people say, you know, I've listened to your show, and a lot of people say one of your interviews is often better than a lot of people's paid products. And, which that's really awesome to hear. I mean, and I've worked really hard to get to that point, but here's what I'll tell you. I mean, one of the things that a lot of people don't know, and this is why I like being on the other side of the mic, is I'm a horrible listener. Like, I don't listen well at all. And strangely, that's what's forced me to be a very good listener on the show. I don't script anything. Like, I don't have any questions planned ahead of time. I have an opening question and I have an ending question. The structure for what I do is actually quite simple, but strangely enough, you know, a lot of people said, well, that's really kind of oversimplifying it. It also helps that I'm very chatty and I know how to guide a conversation, you know, naturally, but I'll give you my sort of structural breakdown. It's stupidly simple. The reason I don't script anything is, as I mentioned, I'm a lousy listener. So if I was scripting stuff, I wouldn't be listening. I'd be thinking about the next question.
Yep.
Whereas what I'm forced to do is listen very closely, and I build every question based on the answers I'm given. So literally my formula is question, answer, question about the answer that I was given. And I just repeat this on a loop throughout the interview. And of course, the result is that you don't just scratch the surface on anything. That's why I will turn down anybody. I don't care how famous they are. If they say, I won't give you an hour, I'll say, well, that's great. Let me know when you're free. Because we love to have you, but we do an hour interview because we don't scratch the surface. And it doesn't matter who it is. We don't make exceptions to that rule. And that's one thing, you know, I think people get tempted to do. They'll say, oh, this is a celebrity guest. We'll do whatever you want. And I don't do that. Because you know what? We have a standard that we have set for our listeners, and they expect this from us.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I have to work with constraints, but I always make sure that I get that, like at least 50 minutes to an hour, because if I don't, then I can't do what I do. So that's really the structure for it. Obviously, you know, I've refined the skill over time. The other thing that I keep in mind, and, you know, a lot of this has been driven by listener feedback, because one of my listeners actually told me, he's like, you interrupt your guests. You don't listen. This was in the early days of the show. So I made sure I was very conscious of that from that point forward. And he even emailed me back 4 months later. He said, I noticed that you've really worked at refining this. And I was like, okay, cool. The other thing that I really think about is, okay, is the person listening to this getting value, right? Because again, you know, we go back to my whole small army thing, is attention is this incredibly valuable currency, right? The fact that somebody is giving you their attention in a world where interruptions are, you know, I mean, let's face it, there's now 200,000 shows in iTunes, if I remember correctly from your webinar, maybe more. And people are listening to other ones as well. Like, so the thing you think about is, okay, is the person that is listening to this, are they getting value out of it? Like, one woman told me she watches one TV, she watches PBS, and she listens to our show. And those are the only two things that keep her attention for an extended period of time. So to me, it's kind of like, okay, what value is the person who's listening getting out of this? And the other thing is, when you think about what does value mean, to me, it's, are they going to walk away with something that they can act on, or is there going to be something actionable? And you know what? You may not always get something actionable. Sometimes it's inspiring. One thing that I don't think enough podcasters think about, and I'm glad you kind of touched on it yesterday when you were in the webinar, is I think that there's an entertainment component to being on on a podcast. And like, you can't just take the information that you're giving out via your blog and read it and think that that's going to lead to a successful podcast. You know, it's funny because people know me by my voice. It's really weird when people tell you, by the way, you're my daily commute to work every day.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
And so, you know, part of that makes me realize, you know, there is – like, let's forget sort of the business world of podcasting and go look at the people who are truly successful at a level that none of us are at yet. I mean, we look at sort of in our world, we say, okay, Pat Flynn and Mike Stelzner, and those are the standards. But really, if you think about it, the people who are getting just massive are the entertainers.
Yep.
Like the Mark Marons, the Adam Carollas.
Yep.
Because they understand that, you know what, we're in an entertainment medium as well. So I think that part of what has made our show successful is that we do have an entertainment component to it. One thing that was surprising to me was when listeners said, you know, we listen for you just as much as we listen for your guests.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good chunk of it. I mean, and I'm happy to answer more questions about it.
Well, just so much right there. I mean, literally, I love the listener because a lot of people don't always focus on that. They want to maybe get certain information. That's why you want to know your listener base too, of who's connecting with you and what you're talking about. So let's back up for a second. So I love the breakdown of how you interview. I think it's so brilliant. And when you start your own show, just so everybody knows, I mean, literally the amount of knowledge that you learn is just phenomenal, but your presentation and how you connect with people, your communication level just goes through the roof. So if you can talk a little bit more about that, about how, because interviewing, it's an art. It really is. And the better questions you ask, and I'm trying to get better at this myself, the better answers you get. So kind of share a little bit about that and how you do that.
Okay. So the number one thing I think that really helps me is presence, right? I mean, a lot of my ideas on presence come from the fact that I'm a surfer, and there's nobody that doesn't know that. I mean, if you follow me online at all, it's very obvious that surfing kind of is the driving force of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you surf, you have to be present, because if you're not, I mean, you're done. You're underwater. You'll be submerged. And so when I interview people, one of the things that I have had to train myself to do is, because I'm super ADD. Like I'm it's funny because people will ask me, what podcast do you listen to? And I honestly wasn't a very big podcast listener because I don't have the attention span for them. And you know, now that I found out you can play them on 2X, you know, every now and then I'll go in and listen to things that I want to check out. But the thing that for me has been really instrumental, and it's funny because I've noticed when I've talked to people on Skype, now I'm super like hyper aware of it. Like I was talking to a friend the other day that I hadn't talked to in a while at Skype, and I was like, okay, she's not listening. This is bullshit. I'm like, stop talking to her now.
Yeah.
And she's a good friend of mine. Like I you know, she's somebody that I could tell she wasn't listening to anything I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I do is when I'm interviewing somebody, it's like literally I might have a piece of paper and a pen at most. And the only reason I do this, I don't even take notes during my interviews because even that would be too distracting. I will share a technique that I do use during certain interviews when I'm not completely sure of about how to sort of take the interview direction. Like I shut down everything, no Twitter, no Facebook, nothing. Because the thing is, no matter how much you think that, okay, yeah, I can pay attention. Like when you see your name pop up on Twitter, you see like a Facebook notification, like your immediate instinct is, it's like that dopamine hit thing, right? That they talk, that everyone talks about. You're like, oh, shiny thing. Let me check it out.
Yep.
Which is annoying. I mean, I can hear it even when I'm interviewing somebody and they're not paying attention.
Yep.
But I mean, these days I'm good at getting people to pay attention. Like I'm also conscious enough to filter out who I should have. That's one thing. I mean, selecting your guests is a whole other art form as well. You would think sometimes that, you know, some of my favorite guests have been people that are lesser known because they really – one, they come out and they're generous with their advice. They just – I mean, they rock you know, like people that I don't know or haven't heard of before will come and just, you'll be like, whoa. And it's amazing because the listeners notice it too.
Yep.
So it's not always about getting the biggest guests or the most famous people. Now, the technique that I was telling you about taking notes. So I interviewed Robert Greene, you know, well-known author, guy who wrote, you know, 48 Laws of Power, Mastery. And Robert Greene is not a typical blogger entrepreneur. So I thought, okay, this is going to be very complicated. I've got to do this in a way that makes a lot of sense. And I have to adapt according to what it is. So I came up with this idea of sort of drawing a map of the conversation, right? And so if I didn't know where I wanted to go next while he was saying what I was saying, I would basically draw whatever he was talking about. And I'd say, okay, now we can go in any two directions and draw an arrow off. And that would lead to the next question. So it's what I call, you know, drawing a map of the conversation. Or, and that's what you can make it up. And obviously the key is to draw the map as you're going along.
Yeah.
And so I have this just jumble of you know, nonsense when I get done. But what's amazing is it actually leads to this really natural flow of conversation. That's another reason I don't script interviews, is because one thing that I know is, when I've been interviewed, I can spot, and I can see it in other people's interviews too, is when somebody scripts something, it's very obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love that, how you're the deconstruction of your interview process, of having it just be a roadmap. So for me, I like to have questions. So, but it's more for me on the front end when I'm doing my research, because I do a couple hours of research to know about the guests, but to kind of get everything covered with it. And then I pick, and I don't even ask most of the questions, because we get the live conversation going. So I like that tip too. It keeps it real. The listeners want to have that real connection of like the fly on the wall of knowing what you're really about, and not scripted, which is really powerful. So let's go into how you select your guests, and then how you've been able to build such a stellar portfolio, and then your 300 interview strategy with Seth. I want to come back to that.
Sure. Okay. So I want to comment on one thing you said, you know, about doing research, and this is probably going to come as a shock to people. I do almost no research on my guests. Maybe 5 minutes of research. I read their about page, which is at most what I'm willing to do. And you know, and I don't recommend this for everybody. I don't think this is necessarily this takes a lot of skill. I can do this now. I don't necessarily think I could have done it before.
Yep.
But, and I think that's part of the reason I get these sort of juicy conversations out of people, is because I don't, you know, do this world of research. Because then it leaves me curiosity. Here, let's just leave it at that. Being curious is so valuable in an interview. But okay, so as far as, you know, sort of how I get guests and, you know, my guest selection strategy, again, we come back to this whole idea that it's not even about me. It's never about me, and it's never about the guest. It's all about people listening. And I always keep that in mind. Are they going to find this interesting? Now, sort of what I look for is this person going to be useful? Are they going to be inspiring? Are they going to be entertaining? Those are sort of my three sort of barometers. And amazingly enough, sometimes the most famous people are not. You know, I had a really, really well-known guest recently, and I was kind of taken aback by the fact that I was kind of not – he wasn't what I expected him to be. So we'll leave it at that without naming any names. Now – you know, this goes back to the whole thing that it's not necessarily always the most famous people that are going to be the most interesting guests. You know, like each person, there's also this whole idea of on-air chemistry. I mean, there's certain people, this is something that you really, if you learn to pay attention to it, will become a valuable asset. I mean, that's the reason I have so many amazing relationships online, is because I know when I have really clicked with a guest, like there's something special that has happened. It's much more than an interview. Like my friend Erica Learmark, who is from dailywhip.com.
Love Erica. Like,
something, you know, what I noticed with her is that, unlike, you know, there was something there. Like we were like, okay, wait a minute. This is not just an interview. This is the start of a much bigger friendship. You know, there's a connection that's happened here. And I just had a woman named Laura Garnett on the show. Absolutely loved her. Like, you know, she's actually our episode today. And I didn't know her, but I mean, we hit it off and I was like, okay, cool. And so I think learning to be aware of that is really critical. As far as how I go out and select, so I look for interesting stories. And, you know, I mean, I'm always kind of keeping an eye on what happens. I will ask people who I've had before. That's a basic strategy is if you interview somebody, ask them if they recommend anybody. You know, and of course, you know, if you're reading books. So here's the other thing. I also know when somebody has something coming out, it's an easy time to get them on the air. If they have a book, it's like, okay, well, you know what? I know you need to promote the book. Because I know how authors promote their books, because I've interviewed 300 of them.
Yeah.
So I always know when somebody wants to promote something, they're much more likely to say yes. But What it comes down to at the end of the day is, again, it's all about the listener. Is the listener going to enjoy this? And so there's that. Of course, now very few people say no to me now, mainly because I have a lot of credibility. But I will tell you this. There's a guy. So I don't know if you've read The Startup of You, the book by the co-founders of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman and Ben Casinoccia.
I've heard about it, I haven't read it yet. Yeah.
Okay, so Ben is a fairly well-known blogger, and and Ramit Sethi is a friend of his, because I heard Ramit mention Ben in something, and I've had Ramit as a guest. So I emailed Ben and I said, "Hey, I've had Ramit as a guest. I figured he would say yes," and he turned me down. So you can't take any of this stuff personally, right? Like, somebody turns you down. Sometimes people will turn you down because they don't like being interviewed, and some people are shitty at being interviewed. Like, just because, you have to have somebody who also knows how to articulate their story. Just because somebody has an amazing story, it doesn't mean they're good at articulating it. And Danielle Laporte has a really great post about on her blog about how to give an interview. And she is a fabulous interviewee. Like, I mean, she's one of those people that if you interview her, the way she articulates her advice, she's just brilliant. And so that's something to consider is, what is this person going to be like on the air? Are they going to be somebody that is generous with their advice? Like, if somebody comes to me and they're purely in promotional mode, I'm incredibly conscious of that because, like, yes, I want you to come and talk about your book. Fine. That's, why we're having you there. But at the same time, I want you to provide value to the listeners. Like, I don't let anybody come on and do a straight up pitch of their book. They have to talk about their story.
Now,
That's.
I love that. And it's so true because my research, just to kind of frame that a little bit better, is really a lot more to see what other interviewers have asked people to kind of find the void for the interviewer, the listeners, because there's so many shows out there that to separate yourself a little bit, you want to find the pockets that people haven't gone into. So I like that. I love that idea too of the quality of the interview you're creating. You're always focused on your listener, which is at the end of the day, that's why we're doing this. I mean, it's for that base. So we want to make sure we're giving back to them. So how, with your listener base, how did you, because when people first get started in the interweb, your audience isn't that big and you don't really know who's out there listening, especially with podcasting, because you're, all over the place, but you don't know who's tuning in. How did you craft your message and your listener base to actually know what your listeners wanted? Besides just feedback too, like what are some of the ways that you've been able to do that?
Strangely, I think my answer to this is probably going to disappoint you a little bit. I mean, I do pay attention. Probably the closest thing to market research we did is last year. I got a group of 10 or so listeners, that people who had emailed me over the years and said, "Okay, we really love the show." I said, "Hey, listen, we want to do a feedback group, and we really want to kind of hear from you. We'll do a focus group, but we'll set it up in Google Plus," which was an ideal way to get our Google Plus presence built. So we got about 10 or 20 listeners, and every day we would ask them questions about things. And because in Google Plus you can notify them, we would get all these really in-depth answers. So we used that to shape a lot of feedback. But before that, I mean, we were never really asking for feedback. I guess, you call it the Steve Jobs approach to customer development, because I don't think people know what they want necessarily. And the other thing is that what people say they want and what they actually want, there's a huge gap. So I think there is a level of guesswork and intuition that goes into it. It's funny because I saw, Simon Cowell do this master class with Oprah, and he said, "I just take a shot at what people like, and I think they're gonna like what I like." So, I do take requests from guests. Listeners will sometimes send me a guest and say, "Hey, you should interview this person." Sometimes I'll go and look at it. Other times I'll basically say, "No, you know what? I'm not gonna interview this person because I just something about them doesn't seem to strike a chord with me."
Oops.
I trust my intuition when it comes to that. And for the most part, it's paid off. There have been exceptions, but for the most part, like, I trust my ability to select guests at this point.
Now, I think that's great. It's not like trying to deconstruct it too much, but it's really trusting your gut. And you would like attracts like. So what you're interested in is what everybody else is interested in too. So I think that's brilliant. So the one thing I was kind of thinking about with this is for sponsorships, because you have brought on sponsors. And tell us about that process and what how you've been able to go about doing that, because that's one of the hottest shows on my podcast that people always ask me about is sponsorship. So, and it's growing bigger. It's an $18 billion industry last year of funding entrepreneurs with sponsorship. So if you don't know about that, that's huge. So for the listeners, I mean. So go ahead, share with us how that worked.
It's funny. Sponsors are a blessing and a curse, right? Like, I've had ups and downs with them. You know, I've had a sponsor that went for 8 months. Lessons learned from sponsors. Here's one thing. One, never do a month-to-month contract with a sponsor. Lock them in for an extended period of time. These are all stupid first-time mistakes that you make. The other thing is, you know, again, you got to think about your audience here. Like, integrity of the show is something that I will never compromise for the sponsors. And so that is one thing. Sponsors honestly have been very difficult for us because we've seen them come and go. Like, it hasn't been something that has always been easy. And now I think it's starting to become more prevalent, and I have a feeling we're going to reap the benefits of, like, you know, the podcasting renaissance has started in the last 6 months, and we started 3.5 years ago, and I think we're going to see reap the benefits of that for sure. There's no question in my mind. But at the same time, like, sponsors are nerve-wracking in one way because you're kind of always at the mercy of somebody else. Like, you don't want that to be your primary revenue stream.
Right.
That being said, I think really what it comes down to is, what does your audience want, and can you connect the sponsor and the audience in a way that makes sense?
Right.
And, like, you know, we know our audience is bloggers, entrepreneurs, authors. So let's say dog food company wanted to sponsor us, even if they paid us $5,000 a month, it would make absolutely no sense to have a dog food company. Yeah, maybe some of our listeners own dogs, but that would make no sense as a sponsor.
Yeah.
So that's what I think you really have to think about when it comes to sponsors. Again, you know, the multi-month agreements are key. I think a solid media kit is really essential, just because if you want to get sponsors, it really is a sales job. And I know you have Linda Hollander here. I mean, she probably understands it better than most people.
Yep.
I've went out and had to sell it myself, and it's not an easy thing. Like, if you think that here's the thing that I want to caution people against, because, you know, you mentioned it's an $18 billion industry, and that might have lit people's ears up. It takes a lot of work. It's a sales job. I mean, you are banging on doors. I spend, you know, here's one of my tricks. I look at TechCrunch every single day to see what startups have been venture funded or anything like that. And I think about, okay, what will they do? And I've been, rather than, you know, and I've started to read corporate blogs, even though I think most of them suck, mainly because I know I can tell them how to improve them. And that's the angle that I will usually take to get my foot in the door as, you know, potential sponsor and say, look, you guys could that's be doing awesome. This, this, and this in your blog. By the way, I have this show and I could become this vehicle for you. Because the thing that I've realized, you know, you look at people like Robert Scoble. One of the things that I've asked a lot of my recent guests who conveniently have been investors and advisors in startups is, how do I play the game at that level instead of being sort of a next big blogger? Because, I mean, let's face it, Tim Ferriss told me most of his money comes from the startups he's invested in. Equity in venture funded startups.
Yep.
Quite valuable. And the thing is, a lot of us are – like, I'm connected in a way that very few people are to be able to push awareness out of certain products. Like, I look at Robert Scoble as a great example of what you could become, and we've been paying a lot of attention to him. So all that being said, you have to hustle your ass off if you want sponsors. And I'm learning this the hard way. Like, it's not, hey, I started this show. Yes, it happens to some people who have a massive presence right out of the gate.
Yep.
But they don't just come knocking on your door.
That is so, and I learned that last year because I was interviewing Linda, and then Ron Siever is another great one that helps people with sponsors. And he talks about it too. He started his whole company on a little idea that it took him a couple of years to launch it. And then, you know, they finally got the sponsors involved with it and people involved. It took a while though to develop it, but it is very true. And I really, really like and appreciate that you talked about pairing up the sponsor with what your brand is. There's a top company that actually had a sponsor for 12 years. I'm not going to name the company, but they lost their sponsor of 12 years, which is a highly funded Fortune 100 company. And because their branding and their messaging and their marketing wasn't consistent anymore with the sponsor. And so that is really powerful. And it's a benefit for the listener as well, because you want to have them connect for the right reason. So that's brilliant. That's amazing.
One other thing I will say is this is something that I think we didn't think about nearly enough, is you want the sponsor to be invested in your success as well. That is so critical. Like, if the sponsor just kind of – like, if the sponsor sees you as just a place to advertise, then you're in trouble.
Yeah. And to the other side of that, a sponsor is not your sugar daddy. I mean, it's not – it's a partnership. It's a real – partnership.
Yeah,
so that is brilliant. And you really do, you want that growth, because they can help you get to the next level for your business, but you're also, it's a give and take and working together. So that's amazing. So I love, what I want to talk about is, well, I've got a ton more questions for you, but, Tell me more about your business that you've started on the side. Well, I shouldn't say on the side, but it's, you know, your predominant is the Blogcast FM, but now you've got the
Right.
school life. And tell us about that and how you work with people and how that all evolved.
You know, it's strange. I don't do a ton of like personal development coaching. It's not what I want to do. I never want to be a life coach. I honestly, the school of life, what I thought would be a business really is more a hobby, and it's a testing ground. Like I treat it now as a laboratory for ideas that come on Blogcast FM. Like, you know, it's a great place to come up with content and say, okay, you know what? Let me see what sticks. Like, you know, I wrote this thing called the Extraordinary Achievers Manifesto because I wanted to test ideas. So what that blog has done is given me a platform to sort of concept ideas, to test ideas. And of course, I have a lot of thoughts of my own that I want to share with the world. And so really that's the bulk of what it does. I mean, here's the other thing it does is it gives me a piece of my portfolio that I can point to and say, this is part of my work. It's another one of those credibility builder things. It's like, hey, I've built this blog. I've grown this thing. I designed it. So it's really on a lot of ways, just a showcase of many of my skills. And, you know, it's definitely led to a lot of things. But really the bulk of my effort these days is really funny. I was telling my friend, one of my friends the other day, I was like, you think I should sell the School of Life? He said, your readers would hate you if you did that. And it's true. They would. And I realized it wouldn't be worth selling, you know, because it is something that is special to me, but I also realized I don't really see it as a business as much as I do a hobby at this point.
Well, that's so in lieu of that then. So what is your because I know you've got a lot of projects and things that you're working on. What's your main, well, let's go this way. If you were to start over as an entrepreneur today with the technology and everything that we have going on right now, what would you do to launch your business online?
Oh boy, that's a tough question. You know, okay, so I would look at what do I actually know how to do? This is something that, in a lot of ways, I didn't really have any skills. I developed my skills as I went along. That was one thing that kind of just the way my journey worked is it was weird to go to, you know, work in corporate America for 10 years and realize I don't know how to do anything. And, you know, even getting out of business school. So during this whole time, I developed a lot of my skills. That being said, I think that one thing that you can do is as you're building your platform, there's a lot of, you know, I have friends who have gone out and done a lot of things for free for people to build their portfolio of work. You have to have something of value to bring to people. That is, at the end of the day, that's really all it comes down to. Like now I have a skill. Like I know how to interview people. I can extract stories out of people. That is actually useful in other contexts. Like I do this on a freelance basis for people as well. So the thing is that, you know, if you don't have anything to bring to somebody, and I'll give you an example that isn't one of my own. Like Ryan Holiday is pretty well known as sort of the book marketing strategist for pretty much every big name author. Like anybody who, like Tim Ferriss, Robert Greene, and, you know, a couple of others have all leveraged Ryan as their go-to guy. But Robert and I talked about this. He's, you know, why Ryan? Because Ryan had something that wasn't in Robert's DNA. Ryan understood the internet and the mechanics of how the internet works when Robert was working on the 48 Laws of Power. So there was something that he could bring to him, and he basically became his apprentice. And so in that process, he had something to offer, and he also developed his skills to the point where now, you know, Ryan is a highly sought-after book marketing strategist. So you kind of look at here's what I would say is when you evaluate opportunities, don't look at, and this is something I did really wrong early on, is don't look at what they are worth in the moment. Look at what they might be worth a year from now. Like I recently did the book marketing for something called the Fear Project. Didn't pay a fortune, but I realized being the social media strategist for a book launch for a published author, that would actually be an incredibly valuable portfolio building skill. So that's what I usually think about these days. I mean, if I were to start over, Charlie Gilkey told me something the other day, which I thought was useful. He's like, write 50 blog posts before you do anything else. Because here's what it is. People get caught up in a bunch of useless crap. They worry about their metrics. They worry about, you know, how many tweets did this get? You know, I honestly think that I made a lot of those mistakes. I worried about things that didn't really matter, right? So And I also think that there's this whole idea of part of this is not to knock life coaches, but there's this great sketch on the Jon Stewart show. I think it was Demetri Martin, where he talks about life. People who go to a life coach, usually what they end up becoming is a life coach, like what they learn from their life coaching. So it's this vicious cycle. And so and you kind of see that in the online world a little bit as well. So I think that really the key is go, where you can be hired as a freelancer and develop skills. That's what I would say.
I love that too, 'cause my path in journey was a lot like yours, where it was realizing, oh my gosh, I spent all this time doing all this stuff and it really isn't anything that I learned. I mean, you learn a lot of skills, don't get me wrong, from what you go through, but I like what you're talking about focusing on what you're good at, because I think I see so many people getting started and they're trying to, okay, they launch a product and then they see somebody else do it and they want to like copy it. And they're trying to be in 50 different places and be the expert all across the board. And it's like, no, just hone in and then, work with other projects that you can learn and grow from. I think that's brilliant. I mean, and you pick up so much skill set from that no matter what. And I like looking towards the future because I think a lot of us, we look so close that it doesn't really. You can't paint the picture going forward, but you can see what it is, or I mean, your idea for it. So, with that being said, what are you? What I'm all over the place today. I've had too much coffee. What are your predictions for social media going forward and the trends that you see with online media and marketing for entrepreneurs?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think it's kind of amusing to me to see the podcasting renaissance. Everybody and their mother is starting a podcast. Now, here's what I do predict. I think a lot of what you saw in the blogosphere is going to happen to the podcast boomers too. It's going through a boom, but the same thing that happened is it's not like you're going to start a podcast and overnight you're going to be this just massive success, right? And you're going to have sort of it's kind of the 90-day rule of the blogosphere, right? Most blogs aren't around for more than 90 days. So what you'll have is all these people who start, and like to me, I always am sort of skeptical of the people who invest thousands of dollars in podcasting equipment. It's like, wait a minute, you don't even have an audience. What are you doing that for? It's like buy yourself a $50 microphone and record 20 episodes first.
Exactly.
But the thing is that as excited as all these people are about podcasting, I think we're going to see sort of a drop off at some point where, like anything, right? The cream is going to rise to the top. You're kind of seeing the same thing. I think self-publishing is going to be a huge trend because, Guy Kawasaki and I had this conversation. For the longest time, there's been this sort of stigma of, okay, well, if you're a self-published author, you're not nearly as cool as a traditionally published author. But then he compared it to sort of artisan beer brewing, right? Like, you don't look at the artisan brewer and criticize him for the fact that he's not Budweiser. Budweiser tastes like crap anyways, right? It's like, oh, I don't have this huge beer factory, so my beer isn't as good. In fact, you're the local brewer making, brewery at the local restaurant makes much better beer, and he's really an artisan. And the thing is that what's happening now is all the sort of tools that are available to somebody. Every resource that a publishing company gives you is available to you, right? Like, I'm going to do a print version of this last book very soon. And one of my friends named Mars Dorian, who is another person you should interview, who's really hilarious and awesome, he's this really skilled artist. And he said, hey, Srini, he's like, would you be? I'd love to do a book cover for the print version. I said, yeah. So, I mean, all these resources that you traditionally get from the publisher are now available to you. The question is executing at that way. Yeah, maybe the book won't get in Barnes and Noble. But Seth Godin also told me something about sort of that whole thing. He said, he's like, the day and age in which strangers stumble upon your books, unless you're, a New York Times bestseller. Nobody goes into a bookstore and says, you know what, I don't know this person. It happens, but not as much. Right. Really, the people who buy books are the people that are already reading your stuff. And Seth talks all about this. He writes books for the people who are already reading his blog. It's not, writing for strangers.
Right.
And so I think this sort of idea of interrupting strangers is going to come to an end. People are going to be much more sort of community centric. You're going to see much more of what Seth would call tribes. Like, AJ Leon is a great example of this. I don't know if you follow his work. He has a site called Pursuit of Everything. Literally, honestly, nobody knew who he was about 6 to 8 months ago. Now you can't look through your Facebook feed without somebody mentioning him at least once or twice a day.
Yeah.
And it's because he's cultivated. He basically looked at who was already paying attention and he did everything for them. Everything is about the people that are already paying attention to him.
Yeah.
Not not interrupting a bunch of people who are strangers. So that's a trend I think you're going
to
see.
Yeah. Well, I want to interject though really quick, because the whole concept of the tribe, that's one of the biggest things why I focus on helping people get started with podcasting and doing that, is because that's how you can build that loyal listener and that tribe. Because just what you're talking about, we don't just write. I mean, the marketing place is so loud out there with all the books, all the content, especially with Kindle. I mean, like Tim Ferriss's book, his last book did more sales with the digital version for the first time. I mean, it's crazy what's going on now with how you can self-publish. So what are your process and thoughts on how do you build that tribe and that following? Because that is a skill of being able to do that. And what do you think are the best outlets for people to be able to do that and connect with people?
Okay, so by outlets, do you mean certain like channels as far as
social media, Twitter, whatever you think that's worked the best with for the podcast or for anything that you've
really
done?
Okay, so it really honestly depends. One, I think it depends on what you have fun with. That's key. Like if you're doing it with an end in mind, or if you're doing it because you're trying to get to some goal, and yes, it's important to have goals, but if you're not enjoying the process of doing it, like let's take Pinterest for example, right? Pinterest is all the rage. I don't have the patience for it. I find it boring. I just can't get, and my business partner, David, thinks it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I went on it for a while. I played with it for like a week and I was like, okay, this is just boring. I'm like, it's a bunch of pictures and quotes and I'm not interested in, you know, like I just couldn't get on board with it.
Okay. Now
that being said, I think that really it's not necessarily about the platform. It's what you do on that platform. And so for me, it's been Twitter and Facebook and then Google+. And then, of course, email is another one. But it's funny, you know, I think really the small army strategy is about building a tribe. And what I do is not necessarily look at the platforms. Let's forget about platform altogether.
Perfect.
Because that's like, I'm not going to tell you anything that anybody doesn't already know. There's one thing that underlies all of these platforms. You know what it is? People. So to me, that's what you have to focus on, is who is actually behind it. Because it's not just an avatar. It's not just a profile picture. It's a real person. And when you focus on that, that's how things get built.
Like, yeah.
To me, that's always been the thing I think that's the thing that people really see about my brand, is that I understand that. I mean, and part of it is that that's just the way I'm naturally built. One of my friends said something really brilliant. His name is Colin Wright. It's a site called Exile Lifestyle. So too many people are building an audience of numbers instead of an audience of people.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
So the platforms are irrelevant. So yeah, I don't necessarily think it's about platform. I think it's about the platform is really a facilitator. It's a connection tool. And what it connects you to is other people.
Yeah. Okay. So when you're talking about with the listeners of building it for them, I think that's so crucial that so many people have missed in the marketplace, especially now with the publishing world of writing books, because, you know, and I think Tim Ferriss talks about this. A lot of other experts talk about this, is people forgot who's on the end of the, you know, who's buying the books or whatever it is for your products and services. So with you building your tribe, you were talking about people, and it's mm-hmm. people at the end of the day. So can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I think I've done is made myself ridiculously accessible, almost to a fault. The thing is, sometimes I think people perceive our audiences to be way bigger than they are, right? And Chris Gilbert really kind of taught me something valuable. He said, you know, so you have 15 people who are paying attention. Treat those people like the most important people in the world, because I track down people who I know are supporting my work. And I've been trying to figure out why my last book has been selling well, because I really want to find out who linked it. I don't think it's doing this on its own. I think somebody mentioned it somewhere on a big blog. And I've been dying to figure out who it is, because I owe them a huge debt of gratitude for doing that. Mm-hmm. So I make it a point to really, like, I have one-on-one conversations with a lot of listeners. And, you know, they're not conversations in which I have them to gain anything. I just say hello to people. It's like, hey, mm-hmm. I've never chatted with you before.
Yeah.
Let's chat. And this is just part of my DNA. I mean, it's just the way I'm built. I like connecting with people. Like, you know, I really do genuinely enjoy talking to people. And so that's why it works for me. It's funny because, you know, my friend asked me the other day, he said, you know, he knew that one of the things I did was I just started chatting with him on GChat out of the blue.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He said, do you basically do this intentionally? I was like, you know, I wish I could tell you that I sit down every day and say, you know, today I'm going to make a list. I'm going to chat with three people. I said, no, I'm like, this is just how I am. Like, mm-hmm. If I see that we have had a lot of interactions on Facebook, Twitter, whatever it is, and I notice that you're in my GChat, I'll just say hi. And from there, a lot of things happen. So and the funny thing, so here's one of the things that a lot of people will probably come back with when I say this is like that approach doesn't scale. Well, here's my response. It doesn't have to. You know, and the thing is, are you really at the point yet where that approach needs to scale? Most people are not. I'm not.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, Chris Gillibo told me he sent the first 10,000 subscribers to the Art of Nonconformity a personal net letter, just saying, hey, thanks for signing up. I hope you're enjoying the blog. And I was like, that is the simplest, but one of the most effective things I've ever done.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, one of the techniques I talk about in my book. And, you know, I credit him for it. Like, I honestly was blown away by that. But I think that when you start to view everybody that you interact with as like a full human being, you start to really kind of – you paint this picture of them. To me, it's like, okay, you're not just an avatar on Twitter. You're not just a username on Twitter. What else is there? Like, one of my natural habits, the minute somebody mentions me on Twitter is I go and look at what they're all about. Like, I look at their website. I go and check them out on Facebook. You know, it's – At this point, I don't even think about it. It's just what I do.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I think you really have an opportunity. Yeah, you know, and I wish I had been like this earlier about doing this. But like if you have an audience of 100 people, my God, I mean, think about the rabid following you can create if you're willing to invest in treating them like people. You know, I mean, get on, you know. Take every one of your email subscribers that actually communicates with you and chat with them on Skype. You got 100 fans on Facebook and you talk to them daily, have a Skype chat with them. You'd be amazed what you learn just from a few conversations.
Yes, that's what it's about. I mean, you know, Kyle Garrett, I love him. He's a big videographer and I had him on my show and he's like, you know, when you're getting started, you know, how did he say this? Now I just forgot. Support the few and the many will come, because serve the few and the many will come and follow. And it's with, like, you have a huge audience. You really do. I mean, I know you say that it's not huge, 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 but it really is a big audience. And it's such a tight tribe too. I mean, people, 95% of them listen to the interviews that you do. I mean, that is phenomenal. And you have high interaction. That is amazing. And it comes with that personal connection. And I think that's, for me, what I see is that's the missing piece for a lot of people, and what's going to be going forward is you have to have that connection nowadays, because the days of the shiny, just crazy marketing are way over. So thank you for sharing that. That's just brilliant. So I want to, I could talk to you for another like 4 hours right now with so many different ideas, but what I'd love to do is I want you to just, let's kind of wrap up a little bit here into some stuff and tell me about your life, like your lifestyle. You know, you're a surfer. I love that. I snowboard. I haven't really gotten into the water side. I've always lived in like, I've been landlocked my entire life. I'm here in Denver, but, so tell us about that and what you've learned from that and just more about your lifestyle. Sure.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's funny you snowboard. I started snowboarding this last year mainly because I needed something to do when the waves were bad. And we have a lot of mountains here in California. But surfing was one of those things that really – it was weird because I've never been athletic. I mean, I was the worst athlete on every sports team I ever played on when I was a kid. And, you know, to take up something as athletic as surfing, I think really kind of shocked a lot of people in my life. But – you know, for me, lifestyle was – the other thing that's funny is I think people have this idea that I don't sleep, which is really amusing to me. Like I see it on Facebook all the time. I'm like, wow, if you only hung out with me for a day, you'd be so disappointed to see how lazy I might appear. I'm efficient because I'm forced to be. Like, you know, as I mentioned, my attention span is way too short not to be efficient. That's why I don't – you know, I mean I hated being in an office more than anything in the world. Like that's what I hated about almost every corporate job. It's like I have to be here from 8 to 5. Why?
Yep.
This makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah.
But lifestyle was, you know, I mean, most of my recreational time these days is definitely spent in the water when the waves are good. I mean, it's one of those things, one of my lifelong dreams is to spend an entire year traveling the world and surfing all these different coastlines. I mean, I caught my first wave in Brazil and it was like a religious experience. You know, I remember I got out of the water and I was like, oh my God, not felt. I felt sort of this lightness that I hadn't felt in a long time. Like, something that I don't talk about very much anymore is I got diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome when I was younger, and it could be really bad at times. I mean, it's still surfing out to be the cure for it. I was like, whoa, wait a minute, my stomach hasn't felt like this in years. And
Wow.
I just noticed that the more I did it, one, the more I did it, the more addicted I became to it. But it made me this really just very, anytime you get out of the water, like you're in a different mood, you're happy, you're light. And it started to become this driving force. And I realized like some of my best ideas come from being in the water. And we're so connected these days. Like we don't take time to disconnect. I think that it's something that I had to learn the hard way. I wish I'd, been like this when I was younger, but it's brought a sense of peace to my life. I mean, that's really the thing that it's done. I mean, it's funny. And I've shared this before. I mean, some people know. I mean, I've lived at home for a while, mainly because I've worked really, to build this to what I want it to be, and that meant making certain sacrifices. It was like, okay, I mean, fortunately, I can do some of those things. I'm single and I don't have any other real responsibilities. So it's like, well, why put myself in a situation that's going to be ridiculously difficult when I don't need to? And then of course, I'm very big into travel, but these days most of my travel plans are driven by waves as well, which is convenient since half the world is covered in water.
Oh, that's awesome. So I love with the disconnection too, because that is a big problem. I mean, you don't see people connected anymore. They're like talking to each other on their phones and doing that. So what got you into surfing? Like, how did you get started with that?
I was so I lived I did a study abroad in Brazil while I was in
Oh,
business
wow.
school, and most of my friends were supposed to stay until New Year's, ended up leaving because they all ran out of money. I mean, we were traveling so much, and Brazil was so expensive. It's getting more expensive, but they all ended up going home early. So I was there with another friend who I didn't really have a lot in common with, but he liked to surf, and I was kind of getting bored of sitting on the beach and drinking. And so finally, I said, okay, you know what? I'm gonna just get in the water with this guy. And the strange thing is, it wasn't the first time I tried it, but I could never stand up. I just kept falling off the board.
I know.
It's an incredible. I mean, you snowboard, so you get it. Like, it's not easy. These are things that have steep learning curves, and most people don't get past them. But once you get past the curve, you're like, oh my God, you've discovered the greatest thing since sliced bread. So I was on this beach in Brazil, in the south of Brazil, in this tiny little town where we were spending New Year's. And it was 2 days before I left, which pisses me off to this day because, I was there for 6 months and I hardly ever surfed. And I stood up, and it was in that moment I was so hooked. But what really caused it to turn into this huge lifestyle was, one, I went to business school at Pepperdine, which is in Malibu. I was in Brazil thinking, wait a minute, I've been going to business school in front of the ocean for the last year. I've never thought to try surfing. What the hell is wrong with me? It took living in another country to realize what's right in front of me is something that I appreciate. Granted, the water is freezing here and you have to wear wetsuits, which sucks. But then, I graduated from business school and I was unemployed for almost 8 months. So I needed a way to keep myself from going nuts. So that's when I started my blog. But the other thing I started was surfing. So I surfed 6 hours a day for 8 months straight.
Wow.
And from that point forward, it was just like a drug. I mean, fortunately, the first real the job I had allowed me to surf almost every day because I only had to be in the office 3 days a week. That turned out to be the best winter California had had in 10 years because of an
Wow.
El Nino year. So we got a lot of storms that year. And then I lived in Costa Rica for 6 months where I was doing 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the evening. And it's honestly, I can't fathom my life without it. My life seems like I can't even recognize my life before it. It's hard to see that. It's like, wow, what did I like? Part of me wonders, like, what was my time consumed with before all this? Like, how could it have? What would I do? It couldn't have been that interesting.
That's so interesting when we have those epiphanies and things that we get into. I that's so awesome. So where are the best places that you've caught the best waves? Like, tell us about that. Like, I don't even know anything of really the surfing nature at all. So I'm always curious about this.
Well, Costa Rica definitely is world class. There's no question in my mind that I realize why it's considered a world class surf spot after spending 6 months there and coming back to California. I mean, don't get me wrong, California's definitely got its fair share of waves. I mean, most of my days when I'm not in front of the computer are spent in San Clemente, which is South Orange County.
I've heard about,
And so it really, the other thing is it's this just beautiful medium, right? Like every time you're in it, you're like, wow, this is unreal. it never gets old. It's different every single time. You know, and so it's super addictive for that reason, because there's a the novelty never wears off. Like, every single wave is different. Every single session is different. But I mean, some of the most amazing days of my life have been spent out in Costa Rica, and you're just like, wow, this is unreal. I mean, you're literally riding a wave and the sun's going down over the ocean, and you're it's this really bizarre feeling. You're kind of like, wow. That's why people say it's like a religious experience.
I need to get out to California and start surfing, because I love snowboarding. It's kind of the same for me with snowboarding. It's that release. It's that you just get out and you're in nature and it's just amazing. But there's something with liquid water that's just really cool. So, well, this has been an absolute blast. Thank you so much for this amazing content. I want to do this again because there's so much more I want to go into. But I want you to share with everybody where they can go find out more about you and any new progress or anything that you're working on right now.
Yeah, so you can find us on iTunes if you do a search for Blogcast FM. There's probably about 60 or 70 interviews. I don't remember how many. I think iTunes, you have 50 or so of your latest interviews. And there you'll find our interviews with Seth Godin, Chris Brogan, Guy Kawasaki, Tim Ferriss, Danielle Laporte, pretty much anybody who's who we consider a celebrity online. And then if you go to Amazon, my latest book, The Small Army Strategy, is just 99 cents. So those are the two places you can find me. And, of course, we have our newsletter for Blogcast FM, so that's another way people can connect with me.
Awesome. And I'm going to have this on my blog with all the details and all the places that you can connect with Srini as well. So again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I had an absolute blast, and I'll let you get back to your day. And thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thanks for tuning in. My name's Chris, and you were just listening to the Secrets of the Extraordinarily Successful podcast. And stay tuned for more interviews to help you in the areas of business, marketing, and mindset to help you explode your business and create a lifestyle of your dreams. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review and a 5-star so other entrepreneurs can find this to help them in their journey. And I'll be sure to give you a shout out on the next podcast. Go out and make it a great day.